Bridgeport, Connecticut.
Hello, I'm Laura Modlin, and I'd like to welcome you to WPKN's Mic Check, which comes to you every Sunday at 5:30 p.m. Our diverse roster of hosts presents a wide range of topics for discussion, focusing on global, national, and regional issues and their effect on our local community. On today's show, we have Louise Washer. She's president of the Norwalk River Watershed Association and is a co-founder of the Pollinator Pathway and a member of the executive board. The Pollinator Pathway, founded in Wilton in 2017, is a grassroots network of over 350 communities across 20 states and Canada and supports diverse communities working together to restore and connect habitat for native pollinators. Very happy we're going to be talking about pollinators today. So why pollinators, Louise?
Thank you, Laura. Thank you for having me.
Welcome.
Well, we need pollinators and they are in steep decline. So most people have heard we need to save the bees. But the reasons are so many. You hear often that every third bite you take, a third of our food supply depends on the presence of pollinators. The thing is, we need to be worried about the pollinators. We need to be worried about the whole insect population. And there are a couple different reasons. But we rely on them. They're the base of our ecosystems. So losing them really threatens everything. I mean, back to the pollinators, if you think about it, yes, we need them to pollinate, you know, our blueberries and our tomatoes and the foods we eat, but also just all the flowers you see when you go outside, almost all of them, some are wind pollinated, rely on our native pollinators to procreate.
So how did the idea for the Pollinator Pathway begin?
It was the brilliant idea of Donna Merrill, who is now the executive director of the Pollinator Pathway. She was tasked, so she was working for the Hudson to Housatonic Conservation Partnership, which is a group of just hundreds of conservation organizations between the two rivers, the Hudson and the Housatonic, so New York and Connecticut. And she was tasked with trying to figure out a way to do outreach to homeowners to talk to them about managing their own properties more sustainably. So H2H is the short for Hudson to Housatonic Conservation Partnership. They are working with other regional conservation partnerships to sort of try to preserve some of the forests left in New England and reconnect habitat and sort of large scale conservation. But when they look at areas like ours, Westchester and Fairfield County down here in Southwest Connecticut, especially, how do you reconnect down here? Like the landscape is really fractured. It's fragmented. It's our yards, basically, and our parks. So she was tasked with looking for a way to get the message out to people. We need to see these lands as the homes of our birds and our bees and wildlife, and reconnect green corridors so wildlife can travel. So she did some outreach and gave away some native dogwood trees across the state line from, I think, South Salem to Ridgefield, Connecticut, South Salem, New York to Ridgefield, Connecticut. And people really responded. They liked the idea of making this connected pathway that our pollinators and birds and other wildlife can use. And what the pollinators need are native plants, and they need them to be close enough together that they can, you know, move from yard to yard. Because most of the land east of the Mississippi, I think it's like 86%, is privately owned, and most of that is by us. So if we don't start managing the land in a way that allows life to live, we are in trouble. So that's the idea. Long-winded.
So can you tell people why native pollinators?
So if you want to support your local pollinators and birds, for that matter, and local wildlife, plant the plants that they have evolved alongside. So take the example of the blue azure butterfly, which is the beautiful little butterfly that comes out early in the spring, that the pollinator pathway, we use that as our logo. And it emerges around the same time that the our native dogwood, Cornus florida, blooms. And those two are in sync with each other. They, you know, the butterfly needs that bloom and the flowers need the butterfly to pollinate. So there's so many examples like that of insects and plants that have evolved together. So when you bring in something like a kusa dogwood from Japan, that is not in sync with our little blue azure butterfly. It's in sync with, you know, the insects that evolved with it in Japan. And in fact, those little cherry-like fruits that are on the kusa dogwood, those are a food for a Japanese monkey. So not somebody we have here. So the kusa is not really serving our native pollinators in the way that the Cornus florida would be. So that's just an example I use, like to use.
Along with the pollinator pathway, you're serving as spokesperson and facilitator for their pollinator pathway advocacy and pesticide policy committee to help pass the Birds and Bees Protection Act in New York State last year. And you're working on something similar now in Connecticut. Can you tell me a little about that?
I mean, I came to the pollinator pathway mainly because of my concern about pesticides and their effect on water quality, because I'm working with the Norwalk River Watershed Association, trying to talk to people about, you know, the larger non-target effects of using pesticides. So one of the pesticides that came to my attention over the last few years are the neonicotinoids, which I don't know if people have heard of those. They're called neonics for short. And they are particularly devastating to bees and all pollinators and birds. So they've been linked to massive declines in honeybee, but also our native bumblebee and other wild bee populations. They're linked to the declines that we see, the loss of 3 billion birds over the last 50 years. So as part of the pollinator pathway focus, we, you know, felt an obligation to really look into what we could do policy-wise to try to help restrict, curtail some of the like wasteful uses of these pesticides. The New York bill, the Birds and Bees Protection Act, is really going to get most of the neonics, the large percentage of the neonics, out of the environment in New York. So it's a really important bill to pass. We are trying. We tried for the past 3 years to pass a bill like that in Connecticut. And we have not been successful yet. So we are trying to do things like go on radio shows and talk about this so people will understand the importance of it and talk to their legislators about this issue.
What should they be saying?
Well, the first thing to understand about neonics and the way we use them in Connecticut is that mostly, because we aren't a big agricultural state, we mostly use them on lawns and golf courses. So they are largely, there's one, midacloprid, that is largely used on lawns to kill grubs. So there are a couple of issues about that. Grubs are the larvae of beetles, Japanese beetles, which are a menace, but all beetles. So we're talking about lightning bugs. We're talking about really any insect that comes in contact. So if you, 1 square foot of turf grass of lawn that is sprayed with neonics at the EPA advised, you know, levels for use, there's enough toxin there to kill 1 million bees. So that's how powerful these pesticides are. They're the most effective at killing insects of any pesticide we've ever had, which is why they're having such devastating effects. And then the problem with them is that they're systemic. They're created to go up into the plant. So when they're used on an agricultural plant or any plant, they are taken up into the plant. So whether it's a spray or sometimes they coat seeds and then the plant grows from a coated seed, the pesticide is in the plant. So the dew on the leaves, you know, are poisonous to insects. The leaves themselves are poisonous. The pollen is poisonous. So it's really a problem. And because they are created to be systemic, to go up into the plant, they're very water soluble. So they wash easily through soil and into our rivers. And that's where they're causing a lot of other problems. So they are also lethal to aquatic life. So for the fly fishermen out there, mayflies and caddisflies are especially vulnerable to neonics. And we're lucky, I don't want to go on too long about this, but we're lucky to know from the U.S. Geological Survey, they do some pesticide testing of our rivers in Connecticut. And we do know that of 16 rivers tested, 9 have neonics in them. And that was a one-time test that they did, I think, in 2015 or 2016. But they've done long-term testing of the Norwalk River, which is the river that I work on, and the Connecticut River. They both of those rivers have imidacloprid, this one neonic used to kill grubs, at levels lethal to aquatic life. So we know they're present in the water at levels that are killing the insects that feed the fish, the frogs, the turtles, the birds. So the problem we're seeing with neonics is not only are they deadly to bees and pollinators, but they're hollowing out whole ecosystems by killing the base of the food chain, which are the insects. For example, on Long Island, they tested and they found 30% of the drinking water contained neonics. We know, so it's also in our food in the sense that crops that are grown with this pesticide, because it's systemic, it's in the fruit. So if you're eating corn that came from a coated seed, there's likely neonics in the corn kernels. And we know from the CDC, the Centers for Disease Control, that half the population in the United States is exposed every day to neonics. And they've been, the thing is they were invented as, they work like nicotine through the central nervous system. And they were thought, they were known when they were invented to be very deadly to insects, but they were thought to be not as harmful to humans as some other pesticides. But we are seeing now, you know, 30 years later, some of the harms to mammals like white-tailed deer are having a lot of deformities of baby deers, especially their jaws that are related to, that are linked to neonics. And we are, so the threat is particularly to unborn babies. So there are developmental threats to unborn babies, and it's an issue for all of us.
I remember back in my newspaper days, I was interviewing a fruit farmer, and there had been a lot of water, a lot of rain, dampness, mold, all that. And so I said, how is he handling it? And he said, well, he uses a lot of pesticides and chemicals. And he said, but don't put that in your story. People freak out about chemicals. And how can people find out, though, if the farms they're going to are using these chemicals?
Yeah. Well, I mean, if you can get organic, you know, the way to go is organic produce, if it's possible, if it's an option for you, and then, you know, you're safe from it. I think it's also important when you're buying just plants, if you're planting for pollinators, to ask to make sure that the plants you're buying are pesticide free, because sometimes, you know, you'll have a flowering plant and it's been treated with neonics. And then you're poisoning the insects that you're trying to draw to your yard. But as far as we're trying to, like, our watershed organization is trying to raise the money to do more neonic testing of wells and drinking water. This is just an issue we haven't looked at as a state deeply enough. So I think it is hard to know how to avoid it other than, you know, eating organic food.
What can people do to prepare their own properties to help pollinators?
Well, the great answer, as you know, is right now, nothing.
Stop all the leaf blowing.
I would love the chance always to talk about the importance of leaving the leaves and delaying the spring cleanup as long as people can stand to do it, because so many of our pollinators overwinter in the leaf matter and in some of the dead wood that is down. And we just need a little bit of a messier look to support our pollinators.
Can you tell people what overwintering is?
Oh yeah, overwintering. So there are some pollinators that spend the winter as adults. So like the mourning cloak butterfly, which you might see on a warm day. I already saw one in New Canaan actually, on a really weirdly warm day. They will come out because they're hiding like underneath some leaves or, you know, the edge of bark on a shag bark hickory or something. And they can come out when it gets warm. But most pollinators overwinter either in the egg stage or in the larval stage. So say a Luna moth lays an egg on an oak leaf, and then that oak leaf falls down in the fall. That egg is there on the leaf over the winter. So then the caterpillar is going to come out in the spring and start munching. So if we can wait to clean up until we've had a few days that are, you know, 56 degrees or warmer, the ground is 56 degrees. I actually have a ground thermometer so I can see when the ground is 56 degrees. That's when the ground nesting bees, our native bumblebees, the cellophane bees come out first, and they are coming out now in parts of Connecticut. But I haven't seen any queen bumblebees yet. So when those guys are coming out when your yard is waking up, when you're seeing life, then it's okay to start cleaning up. But until then, you know, just let them stay. But really what I do is I look around, and when I start seeing those queen bumblebees, so for our native bumblebees, they're ground nesting with small colonies, and the only bumblebees that overwinter are the queens. So they come out first, and they come out pretty early in the spring. I have not seen them yet, but they come out early, and they are looking for some nectar. So the other thing you can do, they're looking for pollen and nectar so that they can lay eggs and give us the next generation, the season's bumblebees. So that's where the idea of like no mow May comes from. People may have heard of that. It's the support for those early queen bees coming out. You know, if you look around your yard now, there's not a lot flowering. So some of the first plants to flower are those, your little purple violets that come out in the lawn. Those are really important. They're a host plant for the fritillary butterfly, and an important nectar and pollen source for those butterflies. I mean, for those bumblebees. You can also plant. So this is what I've done, because I was like, the queen bees, we've got to take care of the queens when they come out in the spring. Planting our native early blooming shrubs and trees is a really important thing, like spice bush, service berry, red maples. The red maples are so beautiful. They're starting to bloom right now. Willows, crabapple, rhododendron, chokeberry, our native cherries. Those are all great, great ways to support the pollinators in early spring. I mean, I think we've gotten carried away with sort of an aesthetic of just a very, very neat looking sort of lifeless landscape. And we need to move away from that, because life, you know, needs a little messiness. The other bees that are fun to try to encourage in your yard, you know, are the mason bees. So they want to lay their eggs in reeds. So when you're cutting back, like when you are cleaning up, if you have hydrangea or you have milkweed, anything with a stalk like that, if you cut it at 8 to 24 inches, so not all the way down to the ground, but if you leave that reed, that's a nesting spot for the mason bees. So you can leave that. You have to leave it for a couple of years. So cut it back this year, then, you know, at the end of this season, maybe the eggs will be laid in there. You need to leave them for the next season as well. So, I mean, once you think about all these things, where, you know, the ground nesting bees need some bare ground, so don't cover everything with either grass or mulch, like leave some bare ground. It becomes really interesting to just try to support pollinator habitat in your yard. They need a little bit of fresh water. They need some old wood piles and a dead tree here and there, you know, for woodpeckers, but also for insects that are overwintering. My yard is a total mess, but it's very beautiful to me. I think my aesthetic is changed. My yard is definitely, I do rake leaves away from the area where, you know, everybody is in the middle of the lawn. But I leave them at the edges and on my beds and things. And I created under, I have a big red oak tree, which is like a keystone plant for a keystone tree for pollinators because it supports so many species. And I did what I think it's Heather Holm originally started calling a soft landing under that tree. So I planted some native grasses, some low-growing asters, woodland aster, and some bluebells and things so that there'll be something growing under that tree so I'm not tempted to rake away and clean up under that tree. It's kind of a natural landscaped area that I can leave the leaves.
I have this vision of you being very gentle with your raking. So it's
I am very gentle
hurt.
With my raking. Well, because first I was like, leave the leaves, but mulch mow them. Because you can mulch mow leaves and they return to the soil and they are natural fertilizer. And that's also a good thing to do. But I realized, oh my God, I'm mulch mowing all the like overwintering. I have to wait to mulch mow until later in the season. So yes, you're right. But I've just been really interested in the journey of, you know, discovering, well, what is living in my yard? You know, what bees do I have and what natural habitat is here that I can encourage? It's just a fun thing.
Do you have any tips for people who want to find out what's living in their lawn, in their yard?
Yes. The greatest tip I got when I started being interested in this, when I started working with the pollinator pathway and, you know, learning the plants and learning about native bees and things, I went to one talk and this, I can't even remember who it was, but he was saying, stop doing everything in your yard. Just stop blowing, mowing, you know, clipping and watch what's happening and see what, you know, native plants you might have in your seed bank. Like it turned out I had a lot of goldenrod that started popping up and some bloodroot. And then if you hate something or it's too messy, you know, then weed whack it. But relax and watch what's happening there and decide what you want to do from an informed position of knowing what's naturally happening there. And also just spending time out. You know, we got a monarch chrysalis on like the fence in our yard one year, and we just watched that thing nonstop. And we had a movie camera set up, and we actually did capture the footage of the monarch emerging. But I realized at that time, because I was sitting there waiting for this butterfly to come out, oh my gosh, I'm seeing all this other life, like all the bees coming to the flowers, like the different, I started trying to identify them. So really sitting outside and watching the great show that is your yard is the best first step, I think.
So in your opinion, why is it that so many seemingly intelligent people just don't understand or care about the dangers of pesticides, the dangers of invasive species? When did we disconnect from all this, some people?
Well, I was quite disconnected. You know, I didn't know the difference between a native plant and an invasive plant. I mean, I knew that there was such a thing, but I had never identified a plant until I got interested in, you know, in the pollinators and what they need. And then once you do start to identify some of the plants, it's like learning to read, kind of. It's like, oh, you know, I see what's around me. Instead of just seeing green, I'm recognizing, oh, you know, that's Japanese knotweed or that's barberry, which is invasive and harbors ticks. And look at this beautiful little spice bush that's here. You know, so life just became more interesting for me. But I think that, you know, we have sort of accepted this aesthetic that it's our responsibility to keep our parks and our yards, our landscape, just super neat looking. And maybe we've just gone too far in that direction. It's not people's fault. This is just what's been happening. And I think that the landscape industry is both responding to people having that aesthetic and wanting a very neat look, and also, you know, trying to run a business that is profitable by you know, offering, oh, it's early spring, let us come treat for grubs that you may or may not have by putting, you know, merit all over your yard, which is a neonic. And people just think, well, I'm doing what I should do as a responsible homeowner, without asking, well, hold on a second, like, what is in merit? I mean, I think it's empowering to recognize that the one first step, if you do have a landscape company, is to ask them what are they using in your yard, and then write that down and Google it, you know, and see what are its effects and what is it doing, and ask, is there something less toxic, or is this something, or can you do my yard organically? That's, you know, a journey that I think a lot of people are on. One thing people can do is write to us at info@pollinator-pathway.org with questions, because we have experts that can answer those questions. And then there are easy resources like Beyond Pesticides website that has like every pesticide listed, and also the Xerces Society, which is Xerces, a really important resource for protecting insects. They also have a lot of information, because a lot of natural pesticides, so like neem oils and things that you think of, well, they're made from a chrysanthemum, you know, that's probably not going to kill everything. A lot of those actually are toxic to pollinators. So the Xerces Society has information about even which, you know, natural pesticides are harmful. So yeah, there's a lot of homework that can be done, but you can also just write to us. That's the easy way. And I would say advice for the coming summer, plant flowers. You know, plant flowers, avoid pesticides, and take a few minutes to rethink your lawn. Are there areas of the lawn that I could let grow, or that I could shrink my lawn a little bit by adding some native shrubs on the edges? Those are really the three tenets of the pollinator pathway. You know, add natives, avoid pesticides, and rethink your lawn.
If people are blowing away all the pollinators, how will that affect their lawns this summer? Will they end up having to use chemicals if they want a green?
Well, I'm not an expert on this, but I have heard Doug Ptolemy and others who've really looked at the science of what happens when you disrupt the natural balance in a landscape. So one of the arguments that he makes is that the reason we have so many deer ticks, which are cause Lyme, you know, are our vector for Lyme disease, is that we have reduced really the life in our yards to the deer and the mice, the white-footed mouse. And those are two parts of the cycle that, you know, bring deer ticks with Lyme disease to our yards. So for example, if you have an opossum, they eat something like 5,000 ticks a week or some huge number. If you have more bird life, if you have nesting birds, they eat so many insects. You know, baby birds need insects and caterpillars. So if you do have a more holistic organic yard and you are seeing more diverse wildlife, you're going to go back to having a better balance. You know, if you put a lot of pesticides down, you're going to be maybe killing aphids or whatever your target organism is, but you're also going to kill the lacewings that eat the aphids and the ladybugs and the positive effects that come with a diverse and healthy insect life in your yard.
Great. Thank you so much for being here today. It's been wonderful talking with you. And it's always great to hear what you have to say.
Thank you, Laura. Thank you for this chance to talk about the pollinators.
That was Louise Washer, president of the Norwalk River Watershed Association and co-founder of the Pollinator Pathway. My check is concluding now. Stay tuned for the Ralph Nader Radio Hour coming up in a moment.
I'm Francesca Rhiannon, host of Writer's Voice. In-depth conversation with writers of all genres. Writer's Voice, Mondays at 10 p.m. here on WPKN 89.5 in Bridgeport.